The next section is called Working is Dhamma Practice. Outside of the annual rains retreat period, various work projects were undertaken, most of which involved the building or repair of Sangha dwellings. Lack of funds determined that much of this work was performed by Sangha members, but even on occasions when work could have been hired out, it was rare for Lungpo to give permission for that to be done. Work projects provided opportunities for strengthening the cohesion and harmony of the community through concerted effort on tasks that, unlike meditation, had tangible, measurable results. Working for the common good provided a jolt for monks overly concerned with their own welfare and increased the affection and sense of belonging that Sangha members felt for the monastery. Work projects were means by which Lumpur's disciples were encouraged to further develop those qualities of consistent effort and patient endurance that Lumpur believed to be vital to progress in meditation. Certainly, manual labor for many hours a day in high temperatures and in stifling humidity, sustained by one simple meal a day, was not for the faint-hearted. Work projects gave monks the opportunity to practice mindfulness in more fluid situations, and afforded Lungpo the opportunity to monitor how well the monks could maintain their practice outside of the Dhamma hall. Most of the monks were used to hard physical labor in the rice fields. In later years, when the community had grown much larger, work projects gave a means by which young monks and novices could channel any surplus outgoing exuberance into useful activities. On certain projects, Lungpo would keep the monks working until late into the night, surrounded by hurricane lamps that were besieged by insects. Some monks worried that their meditation practice was suffering. Lungpo replied, "This is practice. As you work, look at your mind. How does it feel when I ask you to perform this kind of task? Practice doesn't mean evading things all the time. You have to come out and face up to the defilements so that you know what they're like. Once you've trained, once you have to climb up into the ring, in the future you will see the fruits. But for the time being, don't blame or praise, just do the work." Every now and again, a disgruntled monk might leave, but the vast majority trusted in Lumpur's judgment. Ajahn Liam was one of those who thrived during this kind of practice. This is Ajahn Liam speaking. During work projects, Lumpur emphasized giving up our own comfort and desires for the benefit of others. This kind of sacrifice is the dana, the giving of monks. It arises in a generous heart that considers the welfare of the community. In fact, there's plenty of time, but when we hurry, craving makes us feel that we're short of time. At Wat Pa Phong, we don't work with craving. We work in the spirit of self-sacrifice. We show how making sacrifices for the group is a beneficial Dhamma practice. The most legendary of the Wat Pa Phong Sangha work projects was the four-month-long construction of a road up a steep hill, thickly forested hill to Wat Thamsang Phet, a branch monastery some 80 kilometers to the north of Wat Pa Phong. Ajahn Anaik was one participant. And this is Ajahn Anaik speaking. The head of the highways department said that if Lumpur had really decided to go ahead with the project, he would send people to help. But after 2 or 3 days, the men from the highways department had had enough. They couldn't endure that mat mui, which is a plant which, when touched, produces severe itchiness. They said, "This level of work needs a proper budget. You need explosives and tractors. Can't be done with this number of people." Lumpur sat there and said nothing. The day after the highways people left, we made our own survey. Once we'd decided on where the road should go, we got down to work. There was hardly any time for rest. We would start work at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and finish at 3 in the morning. We got through one pair of flip-flops after another. The work mainly consisted of breaking up rocks and carrying them to where they were to be laid. After a time, the highways department saw that we weren't going to give up, and every now and again they would bring up some explosives for us, and the villagers helped to set the charges. Lumpur would start teaching lay people after the meal, and he'd sit there right through the afternoon without a break. We'd all have to rest during the middle of the day, and afterwards, when we came out, he'd still be sitting there talking with the lay people. At 3, he would start work and do the whole shift until 3 the next morning. Nobody could keep up with him. When he wasn't supervising, he was raking the rubble. It was strange. We were all younger than Lung Po, but we had to admit that we couldn't keep up with him. He would never be the one who suggested taking a break. At 3 in the morning, we'd rest for a short time, and then at dawn, it was time to leave on arms round. Everyone was exhausted, but he kept us going until the job was finished. It was really tough. We put our lives on the line. At one point, I sustained a hemorrhage and internal bruising. I felt a tightness in my chest, couldn't breathe properly. I think that was the start of my heart complaint. Everything had to be done well, well and quickly. If anyone started to make jokes or act playfully, Lung Po wouldn't say anything, but he'd immediately walk away. The next day, there'd be a Dhamma talk. He'd say, "Act like a monk, act like a Dhamma practitioner." Whatever he did with total sincerity. And however tired or weary he felt, I never heard him once complain. In the mid-1970s, a new Upositor Hall was constructed on a raised piece of land in the center of the monastery, behind the Dhamma Hall and adjacent to Lung Po's Kuti. As usual, most of the laboring work was done by the Sangha. One day, as the monks and novices carried earth up onto the mound on which the building was going to be erected, Lung Po stood at a distance overseeing the work. A group of teenage boys approached him. They followed none of the prescribed etiquette for such a situation. The boys' leader, showing off to his friends, started to ask cheeky questions, culminating with, "Why don't you tell the monks to meditate? Why do you make them work so much?" A deadpan Lung Po replied, "If they sit too much, they get constipated." He lifted up his walking stick and poked it in the gang leader's chest, saying, "It's not only a matter of sitting or walking meditation. Meditation has to be balanced by working for the benefit of others and by the effort at every moment to maintain right view and understanding. Go home and read about it. You're still wet behind the ears. If you don't know anything about Dhamma practice, keep your mouth shut about it. Otherwise, you'll just make a fool of yourself." Though that... There are many such work projects that were launched over time. Also, the nuns were often involved as well. So that around Wat Bopong, there was a wall that was built mostly to protect the animals that lived in the forest from people in the villages coming in and hunting them, or the animals, the wild animals wandering away and getting lost away from the forest. So they as well as being for security for the Sangha. So I think it was something like 100,000 concrete blocks. So the nuns cast the concrete blocks and then the monks built them, put them all into place. They built the wall from them. So it was a lot of concrete mixing. So you get very used to the act of mixing concrete there. I think nowadays they use electric concrete mixers or ones powered by gasoline, by petrol, but in those days it was just a grajok, a kind of a large hoe that they use as their basic tool, and the pile of cement and rocks to mix the concrete with, to mix it up, and then carrying it in small baskets to the place where you wanted to build. So that also, with the making that mound, the large mound on which the Upositor Hall sits at Wat Bopong, again, I think the nuns were gathering the earth from they dug out a large pit on one part of the monastery, and then they sifted the earth so that it was all sort of finely graded, and then the nuns carried the earth to a kind of a barricade, and then they tipped the earth over the barricade, and the monks collected the earth from the other side, and then carried it up to be building the mound with it, so that the whole of the monastic community was involved in these projects together. Also, one of the famous aspects of that road project at Tham Son Phet that Lung Po Sumedho often talks about was when he was brought in on that, as most of the Sangha members from Wat Bopong went up to help out with that. The bhikkhus, novices, were all there to lend a hand. And so after a few days, then the young Ajahn Sumedho was really exhausted, and his was really sort of stressed, and his mind was all over the place. And so he quite seriously went to Lumpur and said, you know, I think this is really bad for my meditation. Is it okay if I just spend my time doing formal practice? And so as Lumpur Sumedho described it many, many times over, then Lumpur Cha immediately said, yes, that's fine, Sumedho. Yeah, you can do formal meditation. You know, the rest of us will carry on with the road work. But I, since you're up here and staying with the rest of us, I should let the Sangha know what we're doing, and that I've given you permission. So then Lumpur made this announcement to the whole group, saying, oh, well, Tan Sumedho, he's a very serious meditator, and he's very committed to his practice, so I've given him permission to go off and do meditation, and none of you have any negative thoughts about him. You know, he's got my permission. You know, he's a serious monk, and so he's allowed to just sit and watch his mind while the rest of us are breaking rocks and getting cooked in the sun. And so... So at first he was quite relieved and quite pleased that Lumpur was looking out for him and trying to quell any kind of criticism or disgruntlement. But then as the days went by and he was sitting there and he could hear the sounds of the people working and the rocks being broken and the activity around him, it got more and more difficult to sit and just watch his mind and more uncomfortable. And then after about 3 days, he came out and said, okay, Lumpur, please, can I help? So, here's your krajok, you know, get working. And so he then joined in with everybody else. So that was a very frequently told story, and particularly because of that in the light of attachment to formal practice. So people can be very fixated on the idea that meditation equals sitting with your eyes closed or doing walking meditation and the rest, like doing work projects or keeping the monastery clean and tidy, that's not really the practice. That's something extraneous or it's something that you do so that you can practice. But over and over again, Lumpur Cha emphasized this quality of that is the practice. This is not separate from the formal meditation, and very consciously used that that environment for the cultivation of not just of mindfulness but also of the parameters of energy and patience and resolution and so forth. So any questions, thoughts, reflections on that? Yes.
I noticed that at the beginning it mentions about not hurrying, but at the same time later on it was mentioned about being quick as well as doing a good job.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that can be hurrying and quickness often go hand in hand, and trying to go quickly is often a quick way of losing your mindfulness. I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, it's a good point, but some monasteries, like what Paban Thad, Ajahn Mahabur's monastery, the motto of the monastery is be fast, be silent, and be mindful. So everything is done very quickly there. So so that's a almost a style, so that the training can incorporate a lot of activity or swift activity, you know, doing things quickly. But you don't have to be in a rush. You don't have to be hurried while you move quickly. You can run peacefully, and so that. In a way that the skill of learning to both be prompt, be to do things in a quick way, but yet doing it with a peaceful attitude, that's a skill that can be learned. One of the things that Lumpur was also trying to counteract was, which was kind of quite common in the in certain monasteries in Thailand, it was sort of coming through from the Mahasi tradition, was that being mindful equals doing everything really slowly. And so that he thought that was a real bad mistake, that feeling that if you're mindful, you're doing everything extremely deliberately and in slow motion, and if you're not, then you're not being mindful. And he felt that was really missing the point, because you know the Buddha didn't do things in slow motion. You know, he walked at an ordinary pace. You know, things were done in an average, ordinary, comfortable way. And so that associating mindfulness with slowness, he thought is like an unfortunate connection to make. Certainly, that it's a particular method that they use in the Mahasi tradition, but the equating of slowness and mindfulness as being sort of synonymous, he felt was really a mistake. And so then, I'm not sure whether Lungtan Mahabua was deliberately focusing on that. I think he's just a bit of a speedy character himself, and so. But that has become a monastery style for Wat Phaban That, where he lives. So that then, apparently, I'd never stayed there, but particularly after the alms round, coming back to the monastery after the alms round, is like Ajahn Mahabodh would walk very quickly, and all the other monks would be sort of scurrying along. You're not allowed to run, but we'd be walking very, very, very swiftly to get back to the monastery first, so that the Ajahn didn't have to wait for you. And also the meal time is often the eating food is done very quickly in some monasteries, and so that it's a that sort of be fast, be mindful is not unusual. And so that it's in a way you have to be even more acutely mindful, so that if you are doing things quickly, to not get caught in that hurrying mentality, but just let the body move fast, but have a mind that's not racing, not moving along at speed, or getting caught up in that becoming energy.
Thank you. Do you, I know that, because in mindfulness it is often really associated with going slowly in the other traditions and the secular. And I know here walking is encouraged to sort of be quite quick. I wondered if there's any other suggestions or practices for trying to get that balance of mindfulness, quickness, that you might have.
Well, just in the ordinary everyday activities that go on here, either going for a walk just to see if you can walk quickly down to Hudnal Common and back and be peaceful, not go anywhere even as the body is walking. Or while you're doing the washing up or whatever, just to test that out. So can I speed things up and still be fully attentive to what's going on? And just having that in mind as you go about the ordinary everyday tasks, and so that you begin to get a feel for how that works together. So walking quickly, can be. It doesn't. You don't have to be in a racing mode. I remember when I was on a Tudong walk, we had an appointment. We were supposed to be meeting some people in a particular town. I was in Norfolk, and we were supposed to be meeting somebody in the town of Swaffham. I was walking. This was in 2008. I was walking with Nick Scott, and we'd started a little bit later that morning, and then we got to this particular village, and then looking at the map and realizing, oh, we're supposed to be in Swaffham by 11 o'clock, and it's already 10:15. It was something like it was already 10 o'clock, so we had an hour to get there, and it was 4.5 miles away. And so, and Nick said, "Oh, we'll never make it. We had full rucksacks." And he said, "Oh, well, we're never going to make it." And I said, "Oh, yes, we can." And so, I looked at the time when we began, and I just started walking and just sort of had the thought in mind, let's get to Swaffham by 11 o'clock. And so I was speeding along. You know, Nick is quite a lot taller than me, but I was kind of way in front of him. But it was not rushed. You know, I was moving extremely quickly with a rucksack and kind of striding away down the country lanes. But there was a very peaceful feeling to it. But I was physically, I was zooming along, and we and got there in time, which was very pleasing as well. So that was an exercise in exactly that. I want to cover 4.5 miles in an hour with a rucksack. Well, let's see if it can be done. And just setting the mind to do that. And then also, because you're practicing, then say, okay, can this be done without that rushing, anxious feeling? Can just be that the body's moving along at speed, the legs are sort of putting out some extra energy, but does the mind have to be agitated or restless? And it was interesting. It was actually quite peaceful as the body was sort of rocketing along the country lanes.
It's keeping that peace.
So yeah, it's all in the attitude. Yeah. It's in the attitude. So Lumpur Cha would talk about it as walking one step at a time. So you can run one step at a time too. So it's all hinges on the attitude that you have. It's not the activity that's going on. So people, I would say in playing music, you know, sometimes there's a piece of music that you're playing, people playing in an orchestra, the piece of music might demand that you have to play very, very quickly, but you also have to be completely focused on the present, to be listening to the other instruments that you're harmonizing with and watching what the conductor's doing, but your hands are moving, you know, incredibly quickly, incredibly sort of large number of notes per second to keep up with it, but the concentration is strongly fixed on the present moment. Okay, the next section is called Toraman, which literally means torture. One of the distinctive features of the training developed by Lumpur at Wat Bapong were practices aimed at thwarting the monks' desires in order to encourage them to look directly at the ways in which craving produced suffering and how letting go of it led to peace. And of course, as usual, the word monks includes all monastics, not just, he was equally happy to thwart the nuns in their kind of their habits of craving. So it's a more of a general term, referring to the monastic community. So thwarting, to thwart means to obstruct or to frustrate or to prevent from happening. The Thai word for this kind of training is toraman. In everyday use, toraman has lost its sense of training and now refers simply to torture or torment. Quoting the Four Noble Truths, Lumpur would insist that suffering ceases not through turning our back on it, but by fully comprehending its nature. And this is Lumpur Cha speaking here. If you don't want to suffer, then you won't see suffering. If you don't see suffering, then you won't fully comprehend it. And if you don't fully comprehend suffering, you won't be able to remove it from your mind. The reason we don't free ourselves from suffering is, precisely, because we're always trying to get away from it. If you want to put out a fire, you have to pour water on the flames. Running away from suffering simply makes things worse. You can climb on a plane, but the suffering will go with you. You can dive down into the ocean, but your suffering will dive down with you. You may think that you're escaping it, but you're deluding yourself because it's right there in your mind. You must constantly reflect on Dhamma to firmly establish it in your mind. Dare to practice. Living with friends or with a large group should be the same as living alone. Be fearless. If anybody else wants to be lazy, then that's their business. Listen to the teachings. Don't argue with the teacher. Don't be stubborn. Do what the teacher tells you. Don't be afraid of practice. You'll work it out by doing it. Of that, there's no doubt. The training involved Lumpur requiring his disciples to do things that they didn't want to do, and not to do things that they wanted to do. He emphasized that going against the grain was not to be seen as the goal itself, or as a practice that would inevitably lead to some form of purification. The rationale for the training was that it offered the opportunity to observe the way in which craving and attachment are often invisible if followed, and give rise to tension and frustration if opposed. Bearing with the discomfort mindfully and looking at it closely reveals its impermanent, suffering and not-self nature. The practice took many forms, often quite mundane. On the more strenuous work days, for example, a kettle of sweet drinks might arrive from the kitchen. On a cold winter day, the drink would be hot, and occasionally Lungpo would allow the kettle to be placed under a tree in full sight of the monks without acknowledging it. Monks could not help but observe that, although they had up to that point feeling particularly tired or thirsty, now, suddenly, they could think of nothing other than enjoying a hot drink. If the monks worried about the drink getting cold before they got to drink it, they would immediately begin to suffer. As long as they kept their ears open for the invitation from Lungpo to stop work, the time would drag intolerably, and they would suffer. The moment they gave up and put their minds on the work, thinking, if there's a drink, there's a drink. If there's no drink, that's all right too. Then the suffering would cease. Toroman is a teaching strategy that demands that the students have great confidence in the teacher. If they harbor the slightest doubt about his wisdom or compassion, they'll find it hard to follow this path consistently. The fortitude needed to bear with the unpleasant comes from believing in the ultimate benefit of doing so. Lungpo was able to command that faith without difficulty. Lungpo would tell the monks that when they were put in uncomfortable situations and began to feel oppressed, it was important to recognize that it was the defilements, not they themselves, that were being opposed. Only if they refused to assume ownership of the unpleasant sensations would they benefit from the practice. At mealtimes, he would say that the defilements want the food hot and fast. Dhamma wants the food cold and slow. It's fortunate that Amaravati is famous for cool food on the servery. By the time even those of us who go first get to it, it's often quite cold by the time I get there, let alone the last of the Anigari cars. So that's the way it is. So the Dhamma wants food cold and slow. When you don't get the food that you want, how you want it, when you want it, how does it feel? I find it's actually quite strange going on the retreats at the retreat center, because usually the first couple of days of the retreat, at the mealtime, I think, there's something strange about this food. There's something weird. What? Oh, it's hot. Oh, right. Wow, yes, hot food. I forgot. Yeah, that's right. Food is sometimes hot. Yeah, right, right. Okay, good. Yeah, I forgot that. I'm not criticizing the kitchen, but it's just the way things work out here. It's something that Amaravati is known for as a cool food offerings. On weekend mornings, lay supporters from Warin and Ubon, the two of the local towns, would arrive with food to offer for the Sangha's daily meal. The food tended to be richer than the usual daily fare, and it was an open secret that many monks looked forward to the weekend with pleasure. On days when the food was plentiful, Lungpo liked to sit talking to the donors after the food had been distributed, while his disciples sat, bowls full of food in front of them, struggling with feelings of restlessness, greed and hunger. Finally, after a period of time that to some of the monks had seemed excruciatingly long, but had in fact rarely lasted more than 5 or 10 minutes, Lungpo would raise his hands and begin the blessing chant, Yatha Varivaha Pura Paripurenti Sagarang, signalling the beginning of the meal. On some days, there would be an extra twist of the knife. It was Lungpo's custom to clear his throat before leading the blessing. This cough became an ardently awaited sound. Knowing this, Lungpo would occasionally cough in his usual way, pause for a moment, and then continue talking. Toroman, jing jing. Huh? One fabled hot season Toroman practice involved late morning meditation sessions in which the Sangha would dress in their full set of robes and sit in a room whose door and windows were closed in order to produce an almost overpowering heat and stuffiness. Before long, the monks would be soaked in sweat. Lumpur, sitting in their midst, would encourage them. Come on, you spent 9 months in your mother's womb. This bears no comparison. In the cold season, the practice was reversed. Lumpur would lead the monks in nighttime meditation sessions, wearing only their thin cotton ankhas and a lower robe, while the windows were opened to receive the bitter north wind that cut its way through the monastery at that time of the year. At least, monks comforted themselves. It kept them free of drowsiness. Though that was, a story that Lumpur Sumedho often tells of a particular Toraman incident was where he was on the observance day. They had been sitting together with the rest of the male monastic community doing the Patimokkha, the monks' rules together. And a visiting monk had come to stay at that time, and he was an old Tudong companion of Lumpur Cha, so he was a monk that he'd traveled a lot with. So they were sitting there in the little shrine room that was used for the recitation, and the recitation was finished. And usually what happened was that Lumpur Cha would give a kind of encouraging talk, an ovada, to the monks' community. Then he'd go off and join the lay community in the main hall and give another Dhamma talk there. So the recitation would happen in the early part of the evening. But after the recitation was finished, then he got chatting with this visiting monk. And of course, well, not of course, but the way it works is that if the Ajahn is talking, then you don't get up or leave or go and do anything else. You sit there while the Ajahn is chatting. And and this conversation went on and on and on. So it was 7 o'clock went by, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock. So they're talking about, you know, 2 or 3 hours. And the young Ajahn Sumedho was thinking, this is ridiculous, how long can you go on? They're talking about the mango harvest down in Chonburi. You know, this is not what I came to the monastery for, and we should be sitting, he should be giving a Dhamma talk to the lay people are all waiting for him in the sala, you know, this is really irresponsible, and his legs are aching and feeling restless. And Lumpur Cha went on and on and on. So 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, you know, 1 o'clock. And so that during this time, then he's the young Ajahn Sumedho is getting tired, falling asleep, and then getting very angry and restless, just filled with pain and discomfort, until finally at something about 2 o'clock, he's okay, I give up. He's just going to talk on until it's time for the alms round. So just if he wants to talk. I've got nowhere else to go. I just sit here with everybody else. We're all in pain. We're all falling asleep. Okay, that's it. I give up. And as soon as he had that thought, I give up, then Lumpur Cha said, oh, look at the time. We should go and join the lay people in the sala. And then he said, apparently, that as he said that, then he looked Ajahn Sumedho right in the face and gave him a big, you know, big smile. Like, get it, Sumedho? So that was one of those very particular instances of the Toraman method, whether it was just for Ajahn Sumedho or for everybody else as well. But it was, I think he could easily read people's expressions and their body language. Lumpur's Dhamma talks are renowned for their capacity to fulfill the Buddha's injunction to instruct, inspire, encourage, and exhilarate their listeners. But he did not always intend them to be so uplifting. Sometimes they played a different role in the training. Quite often, Lumpur spoke at great, rambling and repetitive length, simply in order that his audience would learn how to deal with the discomfort of sitting on a concrete floor for a long but indeterminate time. During the rains retreat of 1980, when his health was already in decline, he gave a 7-hour discourse. At one point during the talk, he looked around to see a number of the monks in front of him starting to squirm and said, "Are you suffering? Can you find a place in your mind where you don't suffer?" One particular challenge these long talks posed was their uncertain duration. Monks could not tell themselves to grit their teeth for a certain length of time. Lumpur might stop after 2 or 3 hours, or he might also carry on until the 3 a.m. wake-up bell. It was a memorable lesson in how the perception of time conditioned the ability to bear with the unpleasant, how letting go wasn't an ideal to work towards in the future, but an immediate necessity. Physically, it was especially hard for the Western monks, as monastic etiquette prohibits listeners of a Dhamma talk from sitting in the cross-legged posture. The only permissible posture on such an occasion is papiyap, or the polite or side saddle posture. While the Thai monks had been sitting in this posture all their lives, it was, to the Westerners, an awkward and unbalanced way to sit, and certainly not a posture that they would have freely chosen for a seven-hour session. But during the course of such long talks, the advantage the Thais possessed through familiarity with the posture would fall away. They would join the Westerners in being able to see the arising and passing away of a whole spectrum of emotions: interest, inspiration, indifference, boredom, drowsiness, restlessness, irritation, resentment, and even occasionally acceptance and joy. The policy of frustrating desire covered every area of monastic life. If Lumpo knew someone wanted to go somewhere very badly, then he wouldn't let him go. If he badly wanted to stay, he might well be sent away. Showing greed for requisites, like robes and alms bowl and kuti and so on, was sure to lead to grief. A Toroman regime is not without weaknesses. It's limited by its inherent elitism. It provides the best results in a small and highly motivated community. With a larger, more varied group, the stresses and strains experienced by the less motivated members can adversely affect the whole, creating a grim atmosphere in the monastery. Young monks can push themselves too hard or become competitive. In addition, a teacher known to train his students in this way may be so intimidating to outsiders as to seriously reduce the number of people who are willing to take up the training in the first place. Ideally, the trainer in Toroman demonstrates that he himself is able and willing to do everything he demands of his students. This was very much the case with Lumpo, who made a point of leading from the front, and not only sharing in the hardships of his students, but exceeding them. However, as Lumpo got older and his health declined, he relaxed a number of these practices. It's debatable as to what extent this change was influenced by the waning of his own physical powers, and to what extent it was a response to a larger sangha that lacked the intensity of the earlier years. Whatever the case, the underlying principle remained constant. And this is Lumpo speaking here. Practice means going against the stream. Against the stream of our mental activity, against the stream of defilements. Countering a stream is always difficult. It's difficult to row a boat against the current, and because of the flow of our defilements, it's difficult to do good. We don't want to go against the stream. We don't want difficulties. We don't want to have to endure. Mostly, we just want to go with the flow of our moods, like water that follows its natural course. That may be comfortable, but it's not the way of practice. Practice is characterized by going against the grain, going against the defilements and the mind's old ways. It demands mindful suppression, increasing our patient endurance. Also, it brings to mind this the fact that, you know, Lumpo would say experience what everyone else was experiencing. One of the Western monks told, who was there at Wapapong in the early years, was that we would sit on our sitting cloth, just a piece of cloth usually on a grass mat on the concrete, or just straight on the concrete. And during this time, the Lumpur had a thick foam mat that he was sitting on. And so that during this particular period, they were having two or three, 4 hour long meditation sittings every evening. And so sometimes Lumpur would ring the bell at 9, sometimes at 10, sometimes 11, sometimes midnight, and they never knew exactly how long any particular sitting could be. And this one monk got really obsessed with how, well, it's all right for him, he's got this nice foam mat that he can sit on, the rest of us are on the concrete, and so it's tough for us. And so that he was finding his mind grumbling and complaining in this way. And then he said, but on the last day of that specific session, then Lumpur Cha very carefully laid out his sitting cloth next to the big foam mat on the concrete. You know, so he was up on the little platform, but so the mat was here, and Lumpur Cha put his his sitting cloth on the concrete next to it. So deliberately not sitting on the spongy cushion. And that was a 4-hour sitting that night. So that then this particular Western monk thought, is he doing that for me? And then he would sit without moving for 4 hours just on the concrete, and as if to say, yes, you know, I can sit on the hard surface too, and that yes, I have got the squishy cushion, which is comfortable, but that's not the main point, or that's something that's just an extra that doesn't. Having a squishy cushion doesn't lead to the end of suffering. It's the mind that leads to the end of suffering. Many of Lungpo's most rousing exhortations concerned the struggle with defilements. He once gave a simple rule of thumb. Any monk who has not broken down into tears of frustration at least 3 times in his practice hasn't been putting forth enough effort. Don't follow the mind's desires, was a constant refrain. Train it. This practice means putting your life on the line. His disciples were to push through obstacles, recognize their lack of substance, and realize that they were paper tigers. The obstacles were paper tigers. If you're sleepy and you want to sleep, don't. After you've got through the drowsiness, then you can sleep. On one occasion, he exhorted the Sangha on the battle against defilements that could occur between alms round and the daily meal. Sometimes you get back, this is Lumpur Cha speaking here. Sometimes you get back from alms round and you're sitting there meditating before the meal, but you can't do it. Your mind's like a mad dog, slobbering with desire for food, and it won't contemplate anything at all. Or else the contemplation can't keep up with the greed, and so you just run with the greed, and then things really go downhill. If your mind won't listen and refuses to be patient, push your bowl away. Don't let it eat. Train your mind. Torment the defilements. Don't keep following them. Push your bowl away and leave. If there's so much craving to eat, if your mind won't listen to you, then don't eat. The saliva will dry up when it realizes it's not going to get any food. It'll have learned its lesson, and in future it won't disturb you. It'll be afraid of going without. It'll be silent. Give it a try. If you don't believe me, then see for yourself. He would talk a lot about courage, of daring to go against the defilements, and how it was faith that takes us beyond the fears of hunger, pain, and death. He pointed out how fear of suffering hobbles the mind, disables, or like a hobble is when you tie ropes around the legs of a horse, so it can only kind of move a few small steps at a time. That's called hobbling. Suffering hobbles the mind, and how reflecting on what's really essential to life can overcome that. And again, this is Lumpur speaking. Reflect on what's most important in life. What is that, the most important thing? It's the thing without which you die. That's what's important. And all you really need to keep alive is plain rice and water. Everything else is a bonus. As long as you have a sufficient amount of rice and water to eat every day, you won't die. Be frugal. When you lack something you want, then ask yourselves whether the lack of it will kill you. Take enough rice and water to give you strength to practice. Don't worry about whether or not you're getting anything in excess of the rice and water. The important thing is that you have enough of those two things to keep you alive. Then there need be no fear of going without them. Alms round, even in the poorest villages, will provide a monk with a lump of sticky rice. If it starts to drizzle while you're practicing walking meditation, then think of those times when you were farming, your working trousers still not dry from the previous day, and first thing in the morning having to put them on wet, going down to get the water buffalo out of the pen below the house. Outside, all you can see is its neck, but then when you pick up the rope, you realize it's covered in shit. Then the buffalo flicks its tail and splatters you all over with even more of it. As you walk to the fields, your foot rot is playing up and you're thinking, why is life so much suffering? Why is everything so hard? Think of that. And then ask yourself what the big problem is about walking meditation in the rain. Working in the paddy fields involves much more suffering, and you've managed that. Why can't you do this? You have to dare to do it, dare to practice. If you've never been to a cremation forest, then you should train yourself to go. If you can't manage it at night, then go during the day. Go later in the day, go often, and after a while you'll be able to go there at dusk. So this practice he talks about here, about pushing your alms bowl away when there's that the mad dog is at work in the mind, that's something that would people would do from time to time, and so that once in a while you might see a monk doing that. I can't remember ever doing it myself. But there was one occasion where in the early days of Chidhurst, and there was a lay supporter, Albert Knuckles, who was a very, very frequent visitor, and he was an elder gentleman. He was not a cook himself, but he was very devoted to the Sangha, and he liked to invite us to his house and to for a meal offering from time to time, and to do chanting and so on. And he wanted to sponsor this big dana offering at Chidhurst one day, but because he wasn't a cook, he managed to persuade the Anagari Kars, which was in this was when Ajahn Sundara, Ajahn Chandasiri, Sister Tanisara, Sister Rochana were on the eight precepts. And so he managed to, this sort of very early days of Chidhurst, so the first group of nuns that were there. And so he got them involved in the cooking, and it was then as now the rule that no food was prepared in the afternoon or the evening, but because Albert had sponsored this dana, it was a really special event, then the nuns were cooking all afternoon and into the evening. And so I was a very sort of strict and zealous young monk, and I thought, this is all ridiculous, this is just for food, this is indulgent, this is absurd, why does Ajahn Sumedho allow this? Grumble, 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 grumble. And you're pulling the nuns into it, and this is all such a waste of time, it's just for food, you know, it's just to nourish the body, what a big fuss about nothing. So I was in this sort of negative, complaining, grumbling state. But one of the senior monks was getting very excited about the prospect of what was being cooked, and was occasionally popping his nose into the kitchen to sort of check up on the recipes and see what was being prepared. And so I was feeling, and I'd noticed this, and I was feeling critical about him as well. And come the next morning, so the nuns are up in a large part of the night preparing all this food. And so come the next morning, we're sitting down for the meal offering, and it's all being brought in and into the kitchen, and the food was being offered. And so I'm still in this sort of negative, critical state. And so then somebody spoke to this other monk. Said, "Well, so it looks like you've been expecting this, or you're greatly looking forward to this." He said, "Yeah, I couldn't sleep last night." So he literally couldn't sleep. He was so excited about the food. Couldn't sleep at night. That's ridiculous. Grumble, grumble, grumble. Yeah, what a bad example. So anyway, we got this was in about 1981, so we'd fixed up the shrine room by then, so that's where we were having the meal time. So we were sitting in the shrine room, and the part of the meal offering were these very large cream-filled eclairs, a large spongy bun with this whipped cream filling them. And so also in those days, as now, the encouragement was to eat all your food from your bowl, but have all in your food in the one bowl together. But we sat down, and then this monk, who I'd been having critical feelings about, took his cream eclair out of his bowl and had it separate in his lid. I was of the opinion that only shameless monks separate their desserts out from the rest of their food, and actually taking this cream-filled eclair out of his bowl and putting it into his lid as a sort of special extra thing. I thought, oh, this is ridiculous, it's so stupid and very, very bad example. So anyway, we gave the blessing, and the meal began. And so then this senior monk picked up his cream-filled eclair, took one bite, then put it back down in the lid, and pushed his bowl away. And I thought, oh, well, all those negative thoughts I've been having, that was Well done him. Well done him, I thought. You know, he's seen his greed, his foolishness, his attachment to the food, and he's pushed his bowl away. So, actually, I'm impressed, you know, because he was awake all night in anticipation of this. Finally, takes one bite, and then he pushes it away and just sits there, and he kind of sat. A sort of grim, serious look on his face while the rest of us were eating. And so I get a few mouthfuls into the food, and I'm forced to realize, actually, this is really delicious. They were up all night, or they were up a lot of the night preparing this, and it was a bit of a fuss, but actually, this is really delicious food. So I was forced to admit that it was their efforts had produced very good results. Anyway, come the end of the meal, and I'm just a junior monk, so it's not really your position to be making comments to the senior people, but you know, I've always been a bit outspoken and ready to say my piece. So at the end of the meal, and we're sort of picking up the bowls of the senior monks to go and take them away and wash them. And I made this comment to him. I said, I'm very impressed that you pushed your bowl away and that you refrained from eating the food. And he said, well, I had to. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, I was about to throw up. And I said, really? And he said, yeah, what did your eclair taste like? And I said, it was delicious. It was kind of, there was like a whipped cream, you know, sweet whipped cream in the eclair. And he said, it wasn't salty? And I said, no, not at all. He said, mine was filled with salt. I'd had this mouthful of salt, so I was ready to puke. So I didn't push my bowl away because I was being ascetic. It was because I had this mouthful of salt and I was about to throw up. So I sort of rewound my my feeling of being impressed. And then, again, having that kind of personality, I like to sort of find out what's gone on. So I followed it up and then talked with the sisters. And then talking with Tanisra, and she said, yeah, well, I was making the whipped cream, and I did have this doubt. It was about 1 o'clock in the morning, and I had this doubt that I put salt in, but then I thought, no, because the salt and the sugar were side by side on the table. I thought, did I just put salt in? No, it was sugar. And so some of it did have salt in, but not very much. You know, if there was salt in some of it, it was only in part of it. And so it turned out that the one eclair that had salt in it was the one that landed in his bowl. Seemingly, no one else had that. Everyone else's was kind of a sweet whipped cream, and he had the one salty one. How it worked out that way, it was absolutely not deliberate by the sisters. But that if you had any doubt about the workings of karma. Somehow, the one really salty eclair found its way. And in those days, we didn't help ourselves to the food. The lay people would put food into our bowls. So somehow, the salty eclair landed in his bowl, and so provided an interesting lesson for him and for myself. You know, it was a very memorable event. Lumpur was blunt about those who only put effort into what they enjoyed and avoided what they disliked or feared. They were deluding themselves if they thought that they were practitioners of Dhamma. No matter how long monks had been in robes, quote, if you're still following your likes and dislikes, you haven't even started to practice, unquote. There was no alternative to total commitment. And this is Lumpur Cha speaking. If you're really practicing, then, to put it simply, it's your life, your whole life. If you're really sincere, then why would you be interested in whether someone else is getting something that you're not? Or if they're trying to pick a quarrel with you? There's nothing like that in your mind. Other people's actions are their own business. Whether other people's practice is on a high or a low level, you don't give attention to things like that. You pay attention to your own affairs. It's when you have this attitude that you find the courage to practice. And through the practice, wisdom and profound knowledge will arise. If your practice is in the groove, when you're really practicing, then it's night and day. At night time, you alternate sitting and walking meditation at least two or three times, Walk and then sit, sit and then walk. You don't feel like you've had enough. You're enjoying yourself. Discourses would switch back and forth between descriptions of the well-practicing monk and pointing out how far his students were from that level and how much work they needed to do. He gave an analogy for his students who were still following their likes and dislikes and not facing up to challenges. It's like, and this is, again, this is Lumpu Cha speaking, it's like your roof has a leak in it over here, and so you go and sleep over there. Then it starts to leak over there, and so you shift somewhere else and spend your time lamenting, when will I ever have a nice place to live in? If the roof was to become full of leaks, you'd probably just move out. That's not the way to practice. If you follow your defilements, things will just get much worse. The more you follow them, the more your practice declines. And then would come the encouragement. But if you go against the grain and keep practicing, eventually you'll find yourself amazed at your mind's incredible appetite for practice. At this stage, you become completely uninterested in whether other people are practicing or not. You just constantly work at your own practice. Whether people come or go, you just keep doing your work. It's this looking at yourself that is the practice. Once you are fluent, then there's nothing in your mind except for Dhamma. In whatever area you still can't do it, wherever you still have an obstruction, the mind circles around that spot. It won't give up until the problem's has been cracked. And when that problem's been dealt with, then the mind gets stuck somewhere else. So you work on that, and you don't give up until you've cracked that one too, because there can be no real sense of ease until these matters are seen to. Your reflections need to be firmly focused on the issue in hand, whether you're walking or sitting. The problem that the meditator now faces becomes all-absorbing. He feels the weight of an unresolved issue or an ongoing responsibility. Lumpu said it felt like being a parent. Again, this is Lumpu Cha speaking. You leave your child to play by itself upstairs while you go down to feed the pigs. While you're doing that, you're anxious all the time that your child is going to fall off the veranda. It's the same with our practice. Whatever we're doing, we don't forget our meditation object for a moment. As soon as we become distracted, it immediately beats at the mind. We keep following it night and day, not forgetting it for a moment. Practice has to reach that level for it to be successful. It's not an easy task. As the practice progresses, it gains momentum. There is less need for the teacher. Again, this is Lumpu Cha speaking. To begin with, it's necessary to depend on the teacher and his advice. When you understand, then put it into practice. It's up to you to do the work yourself. If you're negligent in any area or something bad arises, then you'll know for yourself. There will be the knowing. It will be pachatang, to know for yourself. The mind will know naturally whether it's a big fault or a small one. It will try to look at just where the fault lies. Try to do its practice. So the next section is called Joy in the Dhamma, just in case you were feeling it was getting a bit too grim. But this kind of approach and this way of speaking is very much a part of the forest tradition tone, as it's sort of represented in Thailand in particular, what they call the warrior heart, and so that sense of courage and a kind of a almost a macho attitude towards the meditation. And so what Ajahn Sumedho found when he first started to teach Westerners, that when he spoke sort of too much in this vein, that people would be, like I said, giving themselves seizures or busting their knees or you know, ruining their health. And so he realized that if you say give too much emphasis, or there's too much of this do or die languaging of the teaching, then many of us Westerners take that too seriously, get too stressed, and actually create far more suffering for ourselves. And so that over time the approach that Lumpu Sumedho would take would be a much more of a gentle language, and not so much of the sort of aggressive or say challenging tone to, in the way of expressing the teachings. And I think yesterday there was it came up with, as to how the teaching is adapted according to the people that you're talking to by seeing what has a good effect, what has a bad effect. And so that when he would talk in this kind of a way and try to encourage that sense of vigor or commitment, then often it got people into a real tangle, and people would get very stressed and feel that they were terrible failures if they weren't keeping up to this heroic standard that was being described. So over time, then this way of speaking about things and this kind of language is not used so much in the West, not because it's irrelevant, but because the languaging things in a more amenable and say balanced way is what is more effective for most Westerners, so that it's based upon the time, the place, the situation, and the audience, the people who are there, and seeing what is genuinely beneficial, what really brings a good result, because that's what the job of a person in the role of teaching is. It's not just to put forth a particular line, but teaching is a two-way thing. There's a transmission and a reception. So if what's being transmitted is being received in an unhelpful way, then the transmission needs to change, so that then what is being said is received by people and being able to be applied to really bring about the ending of suffering in a genuine way, and not to be creating more difficulty or more feelings of failure or self-criticism and stress. So I'll leave it there for today. It's already gone past 7 o'clock.